Pope Leo's wrapping up his apostolic visit to Africa, and we remember the legacy of Pope Francis. Father Robert Sirico is here with analysis. A fragile truce holds in Iran, but what is China's role amidst the chaos? Foreign policy expert Gordon Chang is here with answers. And there's a new children's book about the papal election called The Seagull on the Chapel. Eric Clayton is here. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over as we celebrate our 30th year. We've got a great show for you this evening. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and always at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. It has been a year since Pope Francis's passing last April, and in May will mark the one-year anniversary of Pope Leo's election as he wraps up a 10-day apostolic visit to Africa. What is the enduring legacy of the late Pope Francis, and what has already been revealed about Pope Leo? Joining us is President Emeritus of the Acton Institute, Father Robert Sirico. Father, thanks for being here. Pope Leo paused on April 21st aboard the papal plane. He was on his way to Equatorial Guinea. And he offered a moving remembrance of his predecessor. Watch this. I would like to remember on this first anniversary of his death, Pope Francis, who gave and offered so much to the church through his life, his witness, his words, and his actions. Let us pray that he is already enjoying the mercy of the Lord, and let us give thanks to the Lord that the great gift of Francis's life and the whole church and the entire world. Father, you met Pope Francis, you watched his pontificate closely. When you step back and look at the sweep of this, the good and the difficult, what's the lasting legacy of Jorge Bergoglio?
Well, certainly, I mean, it's the fractious nature of the church. He said that he wanted to create a mess, and he has. And I know on one level that it can only be seen in a negative way, but on another level, I think he's moved enough of the pieces around that we can reflect on things that have been part of the conversation for a long time that preceded Francis, that enable us to see things in a new perspective. And I think Leo is the man who can move this forward in a very cohesive way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Francis, look, Pope Francis had a very, on the one hand, he did go out to people. He was, you know, he didn't believe in formality. At times, he dropped, you know, a lot of the traditional practices of the popes, the dress, certainly the routine of the pope was shaken. As you said, he wanted to make a mess, and he thought he could shake, if that shaking would bring about what the Holy Spirit intended. We're still left with synodality, which I think will probably be the lasting. If there's one lasting legacy of Francis, it will probably be this synodal model. Now, whether it carries on, we'll see. But certainly that, I think he envisioned that as one of his legacies.
Yeah, I think one can use the word without the same meaning that the Germans were trying to give to it. And if I detect a movement in that direction at present, I think we're using the word, but we're coming at it from a different angle. It's not democracy.
Yeah, well, this upcoming consistory that the Pope is holding, you know, the cardinals didn't care much for the small groups. They want to meet as a group and they want to have their voices heard. We'll see if Leo accepts that or adopts in any way bits of the synodal model and kind of rolls it into his own direction. But Pope Leo chose his name deliberately to invoke Leo XIII, the author of Rerum Novarum, the very document that really inaugurated Catholic social teaching. From your perspective at the intersection of faith and economics, Father, how different are these two pontificates in tone, in emphasis, and what continues to surprise you?
Well, I think in tone, it's very dramatic difference, right? Because Leo is a listener. Leo is not off the cuff. I think that Pope Francis was very off the cuff. He said things. I mean, how many times have we seen him take a speech and set it aside and say, "You can read this later, but let me tell you what I think." The poor speech
Right.
writers in the Vatican, I felt sorry for all the work they pour into those things. So in terms of tone, it's very different. Leo is much gentler, much more considered, much less ferocious in his presentation of things. I think in terms of content, from what I'm seeing so far, there's a lot of thought, a lot of kind. I mean, he really knows Augustine. He really is embedded in the fathers and in the tradition of the church. I think he's very attentive to his immediate predecessor in a very respectful way. And I think that's part of the shift
Right.
from that pontificate to this pontificate, tonally as well. In terms of emphasis, I think he's slowly beginning to develop his own set of priorities. And I think this next year is going to tell us a lot, especially as we see the emergence of this consistory, as we see new appointments in the Roman Curia, and as we especially read the first encyclical that'll be out pretty soon.
Yeah, no, these are all benchmarks that will no doubt cast,
right,
you know, the light into the future of this pontificate and tell us where we stand today.
Yes.
I want to talk a little about Pope Leo's visit to Africa. He's been there for 10 days. He's visited four countries, Algeria and Cameroon, Angola and Equatorial Guinea. He told students in Cameroon, Father, and I want your reaction to this, because you talk about shifts in a pontificate. This, to me, is a major shift. He said the following: in the face of the understandable tendency to migrate, which may lead one to believe that elsewhere a better future may be more easily found, I invite you first and foremost to respond with an ardent desire to serve your country and to apply the knowledge you are acquiring here to the benefit of your fellow citizens. Now, this address was given to university students in Cameroon. Your reaction to that?
Well, I think that's so sensible and really has a deep respect for the country and the importance of, you know, stemming the brain drain. When he's speaking to these people, these are the future leaders of the country. And if they're just going to other countries to find a better way of life, they're leaving behind a lot of people and their own heritage. So I think that is the first step. Now, it's not to say that people don't have needs to immigrate at various times, but the first step should be the local resolution of any problems.
Yeah, no, to me, it marks a huge shift, because he's saying, look, you have an obligation to stay where you are and to enrich and build up your own culture, your own people. And I think there's been a tendency in recent days to say, well, look, go to the West. Everybody should go to the West. Well, then what happens to Africa? What happens to the East? I mean, these communities are decimated. And we've seen that certainly in the Middle East with Christians fleeing the Holy Land and the adjoining territories. There's virtually no Christian presence left, native Christian presence.
It's a real challenge for them to hear this, though, because the circumstances are very often arduous. And I think having the Holy Father address that question in the way in which he did really calls them to a higher vocation, in a sense. He's really asking them to give of themselves and not just think of themselves.
Great. Yeah, no, it's really important. In Annaba, which is the ancient city of Hippo, Pope Leo, the great Augustinian, and you talked about him being an Augustinian boy, did this visit was particularly to Hippo so that he could visit the ruins of the basilica where St. Augustine served as bishop for 35 years, where he wrote the City of God, and where he died in 430 as the Vandals laid siege outside the walls. Father, what does it mean for this particular pope to make that journey? And what does St. Augustine's witness speak to in this present moment, not only for the pope, but for the church at large?
Well, you can just imagine, I mean, a founder speaks to the heart of his vocation as a priest. I mean, he's Augustinian, and for him to go to these places, incredibly meaningful. And he certainly, it isn't just a superficial knowledge that he has of Augustine. He's written on Augustine. He's spoken about Augustine, of course, as the presider or the superior of the Augustinians. But I think, too, the connection of Augustine to the modern events, I mean, he wrote The City of God and the City of Man. What are the conflicts that are on the front pages of our newspaper in the last years? It's civil life and religious life. It's church and state. And he is really drenched in it. Remember, this is the first Augustinian pope, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And
I think so.
Very, very meaningful. And I think Augustine certainly speaks to the question of just war theory, because he was one of the main developers of that whole understanding. So I'm hoping that the Vatican will clarify its statements on just war. Where do we stand as a church? It's in the catechism, it's in the DNA of the church, you know, to speak mm-hmm. about these things. And it presumes nation states. You can't, you know, it's one thing to be a pacifist as an individual. It's quite another to ask an entire nation to be pacifistic. So I think we need to return to an understanding that. I don't think we have a better teacher than in Leo.
Mm. What do you make of the imbroglio we've heard in recent days? And I'll get to it later, the kind of media fracas of it. But it really is a question of just war. That's what we were talking about
and
what's being articulated. Where do you stand on this? And because, look, Father Jerry Murray was on the show last week, and he said he considers this a just war because you had an aggressor nation terrorizing its neighbors, terrorizing its own people, laying waste to 30,000, 40,000 Iranians, that you have an oppressive regime that, if they have the possibility of nuclear weapons, that changes the math on just war. Your thoughts?
Well, I have a high regard for Father Murray, of course. The question in my mind is access to intelligence. If the intelligence is what it appears to be, then this can be a just war engagement. I think where the Pope spoke to this was the tweet of the president on Easter Sunday, in which he talked about destroying an entire civilization. Now, you can say that was a misstep, it was a misstatement, he didn't mean quite a minute, but the Pope had to address what was said. The Pope is a moral leader, and we need to be very clear, there is no just war when you're talking about in the intentional taking of civilian human life. That's very clear in the principles of just war. So I just wish the president was a little clearer in outlining and that his advisors would ask him to speak in the language of just war theory. If it is the case that they have the capability and have shown the willingness to assault innocent people far from their borders even, then this could be considered a just war. It still remains the obligation of the state to make that determination, but the Pope has to contribute to the discussion. He can't remain silent in the face of that.
Right. Before Hippo, Pope Leo removed his shoes and stood in silent reflection inside the Grand Mosque of Algiers, the third largest mosque in the world. Now, he's done something similar in Istanbul when he visited there. He also notably declined an invitation to join in prayer at that time, Father. How do you read these gestures and this engagement with Islam? Some would say, look, he's very forthright and willing to point the finger at the United States and the West and Bibi Netanyahu when they get out of line. But he's a little less as demonstrative when it comes to Islam and the bloody borders that they enforce in some of their countries.
Well, I don't think taking off your shoes when you go into a mosque is a statement of capitulation doctrinally, you know. And the Pope made very clear that he was not engaging in a kind of syncretistic or indifferentism. I think he has tread the thing. I mean, if you go into an Asian home, the tradition is to take off your shoes. And I think that was, I don't think it was any kind of religious statement. With regard to whether the Pope has been equally critical, you know, the Holy See has a plethora of releases and materials. I've been in Rome this whole period of time. I don't know if it reflects on me, but the Pope left when I arrived, and he'll be coming back when I leave. So I kind of miss him. But I went to a very interesting briefing at the U.S. Embassy to the Holy See on Nigeria, and learned a lot about the situation in Nigeria. And it is not the case that the Holy See has been silent on that. If you go to the Holy See's website, you'll see a really quite detailed enumeration of the situation of both the persecution of Christians in Nigeria. I met one of the priests who comes from the town where the worst episodes have taken place. So I think the Pope is getting a bad rap from the media and from even a lot of Catholics who are concerned that there is an imbalance in his relationship. I think my read of him is that he's just trying to be prudent and open up areas of conversation. He is not a politician. He doesn't exist to create public policy, but he wants to be the bridge builder. And I think we need him in that role.
In Equatorial Guinea, the Pope delivered an address invoking the aforementioned Rerum Novarum in Catholic social doctrine. And he warned that armed conflicts are increasingly driven by the exploitation of oil and mineral deposits. He pointed to rapid technological changes and accelerant of global inequality. And he said that God's holy name must not be profaned by the will to dominate by arrogance or by discrimination.
Yes.
Your thoughts and reactions to all of this, Father?
You know, I think in a number of these instances, you have a kind of, call it crony capitalism, where the governments are disregarding the property rights of people in various areas. And that's creating a lot of the tensions. Very often the people in the areas where there are natural resources that could be very valuable don't participate in the benefits of that extraction. And if that's the circumstance that he's dealing with, which in a lot of these developing countries is precisely it, that the political leaders are benefiting from it and using violence to be able to extract these resources, that's one thing. If it's a market exchange where people are benefiting, being paid, enjoying some revenues and benefits to their communities, that would be another thing altogether. I'm not sure of the particular circumstances that he was addressing.
In an ancillary matter, this is the first time an American pope has ever sat on the throne of Peter. And yet, on July 4th, the 250th birthday of the United States of America, Pope Leo has chosen not to be here. He will be on the island of Lampedusa, a politically loaded location due to the immigration policy, Father. Is the absence of the pope from his own country on the occasion of the 250th anniversary, with 70 million Catholics in the pews and the church's relationship with Washington already strained, is that a missed opportunity to mend fences and, as you said, build bridges?
You know, I've had some conversations with people pretty high up in the Vatican on this very topic. And just give me a moment to kind of narrate what I think are the considerations here. First of all, we know that from the first moment Leo stepped onto the balcony of St. Peter's, he clearly indicated that he wanted to be the Pope of the Universal Church, an American who is Pope, but not an American Pope. And I think there have been, by not speaking English, for example, I think he does not want to get drawn into, it'd be so easy for a Pope to be drawn into day-to-day American politics like everybody else. And in that sense, we would lose a very important asset. I think with regard to coming to the United States, it's always a difficult time for the Pope. And it's just not just in the United States. I mean, Francis never went to Argentina. I have no doubt that Leo will come to the United States. But to come in an election year with an election so fraught right now, it would be impossible for him not to be pulled to one side or the other in the course of the debate. And I think, especially after the recent provocations, I think they see it as not a wise step, because it would drag him into being an American pope rather than the pope of the universal church. I think he will come, but I don't think he's going to come at this moment, which is so fraught with such polarization, both within both parties, within the United States, and now with Europe and the Vatican.
You've been in Rome for the last week. How are they viewing this fallout between President Trump and the Pope? What are they? How are they sort of processing that whole episode?
Well, in a variety of ways. There's some people who are absolutely appalled, you know, and intolerant of the whole thing, just from a traditional point of view. Remember, Europe, Maloney entered this, a friend of Trump previously, very big supporter of Trump. I should say that the president has made Maloney very popular in Italy and in Europe generally. But I think the most honest statement I can make from the conversations that I have is that people are bewildered. How does the president of the free world, the president of the most prosperous nation, most powerful nation in the world, speak to the religious leader who is seen as the father of almost a billion, 300 million people in the manner in which our president did? And, you know, I think there's a great bewilderment. And I have this sense that they want to be. I mean, a lot of these people are torn, because now you have an American on the throne of Peter. So they don't want to be anti-American. And I think they're very careful not to be. But they're bewildered by what has happened since Easter.
Well, Father Robert Sirico, we will leave it there. Thank you for the time. We'll see you when you're stateside, I hope, soon. And I won't leave.
Okay, I hope so. Oh, please don't.
Great to see you. Thank you, Father. A tentative ceasefire with Iran extended indefinitely by President Trump is in place, yet Iranian forces continue to harass commercial shipping in the Strait of Hormuz. But Beijing watches every move Washington makes. For China's role in the conflict and more, I'm joined by author of The Coming Collapse of China, senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute, and foreign policy expert Gordon Chang. Gordon, thank you for being here. We now have what is called a ceasefire, and yet Iranian forces continue to target these commercial shipping vessels in the Strait. The Trump administration is calling this progress. You've watched Tehran operate for decades. Is this a genuine pause, or are we watching Iran buy time while the missiles are still flying?
I think Iran is just trying to buy time. They believe that the only way that they can survive this is if the American public forces President Trump to back down. So time works in Iran's favor, and China, of course, is helping Iran delay this. At some point, though, President Trump is going to lose patience. And I think that if he loses patience sooner rather than later, that's good for us, because we can finally get this war over.
The U.S. has moved to essentially blockade Iran's oil exports through the Strait. Some analysts argue this is the most significant pressure campaign against Tehran in a generation. But others say enforcement is porous, Gordon. How effective is this blockade we keep hearing so much about?
I think the blockade is effective. And we got to remember, this blockade not only covers the entrance to the Strait of Hormuz, it also is in effect worldwide. And that was clear when we saw the Tafani, an Iranian tanker carrying oil to China, was intercepted south of Sri Lanka, between Sri Lanka and Indonesia. That's well far from Iran. And that's a good sign that the U.S. is actually going and getting these tankers that previously left the Strait of Hormuz before the blockade went into effect.
Iran is sitting on tens of millions of barrels of oil that cannot be shipped, and crude oil does have a limited shelf life in those tankers, which may be lost on some people. At a certain point, it degrades. Gordon, in your estimation, how long can Iran sustain this kind of economic hemorrhage? And was this blockade a rather smart move on the part of the U.S.?
The blockade was an excellent move on the part of the U.S. The answer to your question about how long really depends on not only the blockade, but also shutting down those pipelines that Iran has. So we have to go after all of their oil. And to the extent that we can, we need to go after its accounts. Some of those accounts are in dollars. We can affect those because every dollar clears in New York, which means the Secretary of Treasury can cut those off with the stroke of a pen. Now, a lot of Iran's trade these days is done in renminbi. That is generally beyond our ability to influence and stop. But nonetheless, we can actually get at most of Iran's revenues. And then it's just a matter of months, a month, maybe even less than that, because then the regime has no revenue coming in.
You've argued often on this show that Beijing watches America the way a chess player watches its opponent's hands. If the U.S. prevails in Iran and forces a genuine settlement and demonstrates that its naval power cannot be overcome, does that deter Xi Jinping from his expansionist vision, especially in places like Taiwan?
I think so. Xi Jinping has been talking for a half decade about how the U.S. is in terminal decline and how China is going to rule the world. And so if there is some sort of evidence to the contrary, I think it really disrupts his view. Remember, January 3, President Trump extracted Maduro and his wife from Caracas. That was just hours after Maduro met the Chinese delegation. That had to have had an effect in Beijing. But now the issues are going to be two of them. One of them, of course, is Iran. The other is Cuba. And if President Trump can separate Beijing from its proxies, then it's like cutting off the paws of the dragon.
Gordon, before we move on, I got to ask this question about when you cut the spigot off in Venezuela, as President Trump has, and you cut the spigot off in Iran, what pressure is that placing on Beijing?
It's certainly putting a lot of pressure on Beijing because we know that China gets somewhere like 45% to 50% of its imported oil through the Strait of Hormuz. Gas and diesel prices spiked in the first days of the war. But we're seeing some very interesting information in the last couple of days, Raymond. We know that the run rates at the Chinese refineries are well below basically COVID levels, 2022 levels. They're below 70% utilization. And people are saying, well, that's because they don't have the crude oil. But also, we've seen the two major Chinese oil producers, they have sold oil for May loadings. And that's an indication that maybe they don't need the oil. And maybe that's an indication that just general demand in China is much lower and that the economy is much more fragile than we think. We don't know, Raymond, but these are very tantalizing signs pointing to something that we hadn't thought about in the last couple of days.
There's a renewed push in Congress this week to close the so-called birthright citizenship loophole. The argument is specifically tied to China because Chinese nationals have been for a long time flying into the United States. You've talked about this for years. They fly in, they give birth, securing American citizenship for their children, and then they return home. Gordon, what is China's long-term endgame with this behavior, and why has Congress been so slow to act?
Well, first of all, China's endgame is to take down the United States. They've made that very clear. They declared a people's war on us in May 2019, which is total war as they believe it to be. They're conducting unrestricted warfare, and this birthright tourism is part of it. But, you know, Congress, they can shut off much of this without messing with the 14th Amendment. There is visa-free entry for Chinese nationals through the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas, which is essentially it's a sovereign state, but it's a compact state. It is essentially the United States. Right. And Congress hasn't stopped that. So this is really up to us. And I hope that Congress closes these loopholes because that deals with most of the questions. It's a lot easier for Congress to do this than to actually start the amendment of the American Constitution.
China's birth rate has collapsed. I mean, you mentioned this before. Their working age population is shrinking. If demography is destiny, Gordon, does this demographic implosion actually mean that China's ability to project power over the next 20 or 30 years or so is diminished, dimmed?
Oh, yes. Well, China, which now reports 1.4 billion people, maybe 1.3 billion, we don't know. But by the turn of the century, it will be in the 400 to 500 million range, which means it'll lose two-thirds of its population between now and the time the clock ticks 2100. This has never happened in human society before in the absence of war. We don't know what this will do to the country, but we're seeing some really bad signs now. And you obviously can't have an expanding economy when your population is imploding.
How much of this is the social pathology that really was engineered by the Communist Party itself? The one-child policy, that really gutted an entire generation. The Cultural Revolution dismantled all their institutions. And then we've had the ongoing crackdowns that we've been covering for years on religion that severed the moral foundations. Is there a case to be made, Gordon, that the Chinese Communist Party is actively accelerating and has accelerated its own societal collapse?
Oh, yes, because the one-child policy started this off. This is the biggest social experiment in history, one which has perhaps the most disastrous results for a society. But there are a couple other things that are going on. As a society matures and develops economically, it becomes less fertile. That's true across all societies. And the other thing is that there is pervasive gloom in Chinese society right now for a lot of reasons, many of them the result of Communist Party central planning and policies. So the party is responsible for a lot of this demographic collapse.
Are they aware of that? Do they realize that they are the ones that seeded their own destruction?
I think that many junior and mid-level officials realize this. Xi Jinping probably doesn't because he's very ideological. And for a lot of reasons, I think he's oblivious. But, you know, most Chinese officials understand what's happened. And the thing, Raymond, is Chinese demographers have known this was going to happen since the turn of the century. And yet the political system, for various reasons, couldn't adjust and get rid of the one-child policy before it fundamentally damaged Chinese society.
Before we run out of time, South Korea is our ally and a democracy. Yet they have these trade practices, Gordon, that are being used as a form of economic aggression towards the U.S. They're doing everything from currency manipulation to subsidizing exports, which undercuts American manufacturers. Who is pulling Seoul's strings here, and what's the purpose? What is their end goal?
Well, Lee Jae-myung, who was elected president last June, is, and we know that he abhors the United States, maybe even hates us, and that's from his comments. His senior advisors, some of them are communists. The government is very pro-China, very pro-North Korea. And you talk about pulling strings. If anyone's pulling strings on Lee Jae-myung, it's Beijing. So we've got a real problem here. They are going to make this a communist country. And arguably, Raymond, South Korea is no longer a democracy. People will disagree with me on this, but 6 months from now, it won't be a democracy for sure.
Wow. Well, we'll keep talking to you about that. That's terrifying. I mean, if we lose South Korea, you've got another, you know, really the last bastion of democracy in the region gone. I mean, that would be awful. But we'll stay in touch with you on that, Gordon. Thank you for the updates, for all the latest reports and analysis from Gordon Chang. You can follow him at Gordon G. Chang on X.
Thanks, Raymond.
And over on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down with Hollywood legend Scott Baio this week. He talks about his rise to stardom as a teen on Happy Days, as well as some less happy days. He talks about his marriage, fatherhood, the trials of his family life. He also speaks candidly about his faith and his fateful decision to speak at the Republican convention in 2016. In 2016, something changed. You decided to speak at the Republican National Convention. I remember covering this. You spoke for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Why did you make that decision?
Being raised the way I was, Ray, I didn't like the way the country was going. I don't believe in socialism. I think it's a death for any country. I thought that's where we were heading. I have a wife and a child, and I want this country to be what I remember it to be. Powerful, strong, safe, rich. That's you know, Reagan. That's what I want.
Who you also supported and spoke out for.
I did, yes.
Yeah.
But for me, above all, safety. Safety is everything, because without it, nothing else matters. But I've always been politically minded. I guess maybe since Reagan I was politically minded. But I was a Scott Walker guy during that time, from the governor of Wisconsin. And I went to the first debate. And I always want somebody that would fight back and just get mean and nasty and just go after people. And I always thought the Republicans were afraid of their own shadows. Huh. All of them. Reagan, different. But it was a different time with Reagan. And with the internet and everybody piling on Republicans, I thought, man, why can't we just have somebody who fights for the American people? And I went to the first debate with my wife and I said, you know, I'm a Scott Walker guy. She says, no, Donald Trump. I said, you're crazy. And I watched that first debate and Trump beat the crap out of everybody. And I said, that's the guy. So I went to an event for Trump in Brentwood. And as he's coming off, he sees me. My wife pushes me up and he sees me and he goes, hey, Scott. I go, hey, Mr. Trump. He says, come on, he grabs me in the headlock and he says, hey, did you want to speak? I said, what at the convention? I went,
yeah,
sure. And this was on a Thursday. The convention was on Monday. And I thought, you know
wow.
what? I'm going to throw down with this guy. I know what's going to happen to me, but I'm okay.
Did you anticipate the backlash?
Yes.
Walk me through the emotion of
oh,
that.
Absolutely. I knew it. I knew as soon as I said yes to him, I knew what was going to happen to me. I knew it. Whether it was instinctively or I don't know what, or it was divine, I just knew that I was going to catch hell and be canceled or blacklisted or whatever it was. I knew it. But, at a certain point, got to make a stand for something.
The full Arroyo Grande episode featuring Scott Baio is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show, or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, or iHeart. And be sure to subscribe so you never miss an Arroyo Grande Show episode. It's free. Go to Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. The conclave that gave us Pope Leo XIV captivated the world last May. And as the world watched the white smoke to signal a new pope, you may have noticed some seagulls who seemed to take up residence near the Sistine Chapel chimney. That moment of unexpected wonder has now become a beautiful children's picture book. Joining me tonight to tell us what inspired its creation is Eric Clayton, author of The Seagull on the Chapel. Eric, thanks for being here. Let's go back to May of 2025. The entire world had its eyes fixed on that chimney. And then there's this seagull sitting there blocking everybody's camera view. What was it about that bird, that moment, that made you think there's a story to tell here?
Well, you know, it's so delightful when you have a happy, fun moment like that, that the entire world is literally looking at. You know, how often are we all looking at the same thing? And that same at one thing is something of delight. You know, you see a bird and it's just a fun moment. You know, those images made the rounds on social media. And my co-author, Shannon Evans, and I were texting about it. And someone had said to her, someone should write a children's book about this. And we said, well, why don't we give it a go? We had just written a book on Marian apparitions together, and we were said, let's give it another run. And so that was the beginning of the story, just in the hours after the Pope had been elected, looking at those images on social media of this cute little bird, and we took it from there.
Yeah, well, the heroine of the story is Maggie, and this seagull's got a big problem. She's a bit envious of the graceful doves that she wishes she were something more or something like them. What did you land on, or why did you land on that particular emotion as the heart of this story?
Well, Raymond, who among us hasn't felt that kind of twang of envy or jealousy or, oh, I wish I was something more. I wish I could be better. I'm not enough, right? That's something that certainly I know that we talk to our children about. I talk to two little girls, and we want to make sure that they know they are enough already. God loves them as they are. But I think that's something that adults deal with too. I know I do at least. And so we wanted Shannon, my co-author and I wanted to talk to our children about this issue. Like, hey, you know what? We all have those moments of envy. But the beautiful thing about our faith is that God already delights in us, right? We're already the beloved of God. We don't have to do anything else. And so we thought, what better way than to tell this story about this seagull? Seagulls are all over Rome. But the dove is the image that we associate with the Holy Spirit. So what if the seagull was thinking, man, oh man, I wish I was something else too. It's a common experience in the spiritual life, and it's one that we wanted to tackle.
Well, Eric, the best children's books work on two levels. On the surface, you have the story of the seagull, but beneath it is that deeper question: what does it mean to accept and embrace the particular life God has given me and not envy someone else's? How did you build that theology into the story? And talk to me about the illustrations by Angela Edmonds. I know that's always a big part, having written my fair share of picture books, that's a big part of the lift here.
Yeah, of course you know. I'll start with the second question first. When we were working with Paraclete Press, who's the publisher of this book, and they presented us a number of different illustrators, Shannon and I just really fell in love with Angela's work because it speaks to that delight, right? It speaks to that fun and wonder that again we all felt looking at that the chimney and seeing the seagull. What a fun, kind of delightful thing. But also again, that word for me in my own spiritual life, delight is so important. And that's kind of where, again, that theology comes from. I remember, my own spiritual director, at the beginning when we began direction, said to me, Eric, do you know God delights in you? Do you know God delights in you? And I said, oh, my goodness, no, I don't. And that was such a pivotal turn for me in the spiritual life to realize that we have a God who loves us, right? And gazes at us in wonder and awe, and we are God's own beloved. And so when for me, raising two kids, and I think for a lot of parents all over the world, right, we want our kids to know God's love, to know that ours is a God who delights, and to begin from there, right? All the good catechesis comes from there, but beginning in this place that we are good and God loves us.
Eric, for our younger viewers who may not have been glued to those chimney cameras the way the rest of us were, why do you think those seagulls captured the world's imagination in the way they did?
A conclave is such a serious thing. It's a mysterious thing too, right? It's ancient, and it's a lot of smoke, quite literally smoke and mirrors in some ways, right? And very solemn at times. But a bird, we all have an experience of birds, right? How many of us have been to the beach and tried to keep seagulls from eating our peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, right? This is a shared experience and a shared image that we can all hold on to, and one that again cuts through the solemnness of a rightly important moment, but reminds us again that ours is a God of surprises, a God who desires us our smile and our laughter just as much as our solemnity.
Yeah, I couldn't believe every time they went to that shot, there was the seagull hopping around. The anchors started talking more about the seagulls than about the smoke that was to reveal the Pope's, whether a Pope had been elected or not. What I love about children's books, Eric, is that it gives parents and grandparents something to say at bedtime that they otherwise might not be able to summon the words to communicate. What is the conversation you hope this book initiates between children and the grown-up reading it to them?
Absolutely. Well, again, I keep saying delight, right? And that's really the core message here. I want kids to know God loves them. But what's more is that this story is set in a very particular place, right? It's in the run up to a conclave. I think this story could take place during any conclave, but the images here really speak to the one that gave us Pope Leo. At the back of the book, we have a good kind of children's level description of what the conclave is. But I know for me, as a person who grew up Catholic, kind of always forming a Catholic imagination, it's about kind of giving words and images and ideas that grow and take shape over time. So I hope that, before bedtime, this might not be the time to run through, the history of the papacy, but it might be a great time to say, oh, this is Pope Leo. Who was the Pope that came before? Oh, Pope Francis. What does it mean to be a Pope? You know, what are the responsibilities? You know, just little questions that kind of crack into that bigger idea of what is the Catholic Church? What is our faith? And again, ultimately, most importantly, who is the God who is beholding and delighting in us?
Yeah, no, it's a neat back way into the conclave for, I think, young readers, young children, because it is a delightful moment. And you can go on YouTube and show them the actual picture of this, you know, the living pictures of this bird when it landed in the chimney stack and or near it and obstructed everybody's view. So it's something that I think so many people were focused on. When I had the same thought when I saw it, you know, when I was watching live from the Piazza, I thought this would make a great children's book. So I'm glad you did it. The Seagull on the Chapel by Eric Clayton and Shannon Evans, illustrated by Angela Edmonds, is available now at bookstores everywhere and online from Paraclete Press. Eric, thank you for being here.
Raymond, thanks for having me.
Earlier this month, officials from the International Association of Exorcists met with Pope Leo XIV at the Vatican. Now, they brought with them a formal report and a warning. Cases of occultism, Satanism, and demonic possession are surging. They're asking for trained exorcists in every diocese. Here with his unique perspective is the exorcist of the Diocese of Nashville, Father Dan Rehill. Father Dan, thanks for joining us. Pope Leo met with this International Association of Exorcists on March 13th. They claim growing numbers of people are entangled in the occult, in Satanism, and in so-called esoteric practices. And obviously, all this has severe spiritual consequences. Is that consistent, Father, with what you're seeing in your ministry?
Well, ironically, no. I mean, Tennessee, for some reason, seems to be in this bubble of resurgence of faith. And we have record numbers of people coming into the church this Easter. And it's happening in a lot of places. So I think overall there's a greater evil in the world, but happily, I'm not seeing a surge here, not like I did during COVID.
Wow. Yeah, tell us about that. We talked about this on the podcast a few weeks ago. Why is there a rise in the demonic? I mean, you are getting more calls, not only from Catholics, but from people outside of the faith, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a couple of reasons. I think people are making a conscious decision to move a step away from organized religion, and that's a problem in itself. There's people that don't want to have anything to do with God or with Jesus and have said, I'm not religious. I don't want to be bothered. And, you know, we just had it last week in the third week of Lent. The gospel was where Jesus says, if you're not with me, you're against me. And what people don't realize is there's no neutrality. There's only two kingdoms. There's God, his saints and angels, and then there's Lucifer and his demons. And those are the two kingdoms. You're in one of them. There's no Switzerland with the spiritual realm.
Yeah. You mentioned a moment ago that COVID was a cause for an uptick in the demonic. Why? Explain that to people quickly, Father.
It was the first time in 2,000 years that the church closed universally around the whole world. There were no masses, public masses. You take the sacraments away from the people, and there's going to be a void, and the devil comes right in to fill it. On top of that, people were given... money was being paid out by the government to just sit home and do nothing. And idleness is never a good thing for humanity.
Yeah. Father, let's talk for a moment. And I know you spend a lot of time warning people of this, but though there are people who are coming, and I see a lot of young people, I agree with you, coming into the church. Certainly here in New Orleans, I see it. I see it in D.C., New York even. You know, my son was at college at New York, and the place is booming in some of these parishes, you know, in Greenwich Village. Young people just want faith. At the same time, there are also other seekers, if you will, who are reaching out to Ouija boards and fortune tellers and this sort of thing. What doors are people opening that invite the demonic into their lives, perhaps unaware?
Well, one grave sin is enough to be possessed. It rarely happens that way, but it only takes one grave sin for a person to open themselves up to a demon entering in. Now, this stuff, I mean, the Ouija board's still marketed as a game. It's not a game. You're opening yourself up to demonic forces that come through. I had three cases in 1 week just from Ouija boards. And one such case, it was a bus driver who, at the end of his route, found it on the back of the bus, brought it home, let the kids play with it, and heard screaming coming from the basement. And they said, the thing's moving on its own. And the dad said, well, that's, we're not going to play with this anymore. He threw it out. But the kids had night terrors from that night on, and then started having suicidal ideation. And that's when he called the diocese. I think I need some help here. So it's a terrible idea to be dabbling in witchcraft or occult, thinking it's just a game.
Yeah. You've described the hierarchy of demonic attacks and the fact that it's rarely one demon involved. Father, who are most vulnerable to these attacks in today's society? Are we talking about a particular age group, a generation?
In general, I find more women have an issue, I think because they're more open to spirit realms, and they're more empathetic, and they're more sensitive, and I say sensitive to like the spirit realm. Having said that, it doesn't mean it's just women. I mean, men who are having who are involved in sexual relationships that's not inside the marriage, that's another door that will open to demons. And so, in that regard, I think guys are opening themselves up in that way. Or addictions to pornography, other things like that. But the worst thing they can do is participate in any kind of occult practice or witchcraft. That's a direct, it's like a wide open cave
Yeah.
saying, come in here, inhabit me. And people do
Yeah.
it thinking it's not real, or it's not what the people say it is. Oh, I don't believe in the devil, so it's not going to hurt me. Whether you believe in him or not, he doesn't care. All he needs is the permission. The
Right.
demons need
Right.
permission. And when we sin, we're giving them permission. When we step away from God, we're giving permission, as particularly in mortal sin, that we're severing that relationship, saying, I don't want anything from you anymore, God. I'm going to go it on my own. And that's their heyday. You're just saying,
Yeah.
you've just separated yourself from the flock. Now you're in trouble.
The International Association of Exorcists, they are asking for clear guidelines for bishops, more training, and at least one qualified exorcist per diocese. Father, how serious is this spiritual crisis in the church now? And what is Pope Leo's willingness to receive the report and to host these exorcists? How do you interpret it? And do they need more than one?
I have two, and we're a tiny diocese. I mean, we're a mission diocese. We only have 53 parishes, and we're busy. We're busy. Chicago, I think, has four or five. So, no, I think the more the better. Remember, before Vatican II, every seminarian went through a level of training in exorcism. It was part of your formation process: lector, acolyte, exorcist, deacon, priest. So everybody was trained in it. Nowadays, they don't train anybody in it except the ones who actually become exorcists. So that's a huge deficit to the church. Is it a problem? It is a problem. Pope Benedict mandated this. Every diocese must have an exorcist. And despite that mandate, many dioceses said, we're not doing it. We're simply not going to do that. I have people calling me saying, can I fly in so you can help me because we don't have an exorcist here? And I try to explain to them, it's rarely a one-and-done situation. So, although you may get some temporary relief, it's not a long-term solution. I know of a case in New York, upstate. I'm not going to name diocese, but one of the dioceses didn't have an exorcist. They have a possessed woman who happens to be a relative of somebody on an exorcist team in Illinois. She goes to the neighboring diocese, which is just 20 miles across the border there, and says, can you help me since we don't have one over here? And that bishop said, we're happy to help you. I just need a letter from your bishop. The bishop wouldn't give the letter. I mean, deliberately causing this woman to suffer.
Father, critics will say psychiatrists, mental health professionals are really best equipped to deal with people like this and deal with people who think they're demonically oppressed or possessed. What would you say to them? And tell us about the true spiritual warfare that you see every day of your ministry.
Mental health is a real issue, but sometimes the demons hide under the diagnosis because they won't get detected that way. And some people are just outright possessed and have no mental illness whatsoever. And many of my colleagues have said the same thing. I've seen people levitate off of the couch. So there's no way you can tell me that's a mental illness, you know? I have another friend who's an exorcist who had a 300-pound man as one of the restrainers during the exorcism. And the woman who was possessed took one arm and lifted that man and threw him 10 yards across the room. Not possible. So, I mean, I think you just have to look at the evidence. Do you have to be careful not to misdiagnose? Of course. But that's why in America, well, I think we're the only country that does this, it's required by the USACB, every person before an exorcism has to have both a medical checkup and also a psychological exam. The psych exams are about 8 hours long, and they cost about $2,000 to $3,000. Very expensive. So we don't charge the victim that because usually at that point they're not functioning and they can't hold a job down. But the precautions are there to protect not just the subject that has the issue, but also the priest.
Father, final question. What would you recommend to those who might be frightened or curious? They may have dabbled in some of these things they now regret. How does an ordinary Catholic, either practicing or fallen away, what can they do to protect themselves against the kind of evil you've been discussing?
Your greatest protection is Jesus and the sacraments. And so if you're away from the church, go back to the church, go to confession, get a good examination of conscience, go through all your sins, including any occult or witchcraft or new age practice you've participated in, confess it. Oftentimes, the confession is enough to break the demons off the person if it's not a full-on possession. And then be a lively, active member of the church, fully participating in the sacramental life. That is your greatest protection.
Okay. Father Dan Rehill, well, I hope you get more reinforcement soon and that Rome
Me
calls them
too.
out. I do think it's needed. And I know your caseload's backed up and heavy. So thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Take care.
That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.